3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh yeah. Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m. Only double. Clap your hands.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast, and it is Tuesday, the 21st of April, 2026. And first off, do want to say thank you to the Radioactive Show, 3CR's national program on nuclear peace and energy issues. And in the studio today, we've got Fiza and Julia. Good morning, both of you.
Good morning.
Yeah, it's been a very foggy, spooky morning.
Whether it's creepy or romantic.
I thought it was a bit creepy. Yeah.
I was just walking. I reckon cycling or driving would be a bit,
yeah.
Yes, but it's also kind of pretty.
Yeah. Like, it's very
yeah.
It gives the morning character. Also, we really should stop talking about the weather. I feel like every time we have a morning chat, we're yapping about the weather. I'm sorry, it's just fascinating. Yes. For a girl from the tropics, it's like, oh, everything is different.
That's true. Yeah.
Like this early in the morning. Like,
I think maybe it's also going to wake up early the other day.
Yeah.
So fascinating.
Yeah.
Have you guys been up too much this weekend?
What did I do this weekend? Wow. I think I did rehearsals for a theatre show.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah, what are you in?
I'm in this student theatre production. It was like a friend of a friend, and I got a little role. It's been good.
Yeah, that sounds fun. Well, tell us more about it as you
Yeah, I definitely will.
Yeah, that's very exciting. I had the start of the football season on Saturday. Yes, unfortunately, we lost. Boo to the other team, indeed. But yeah, getting started on that again. I think it's nice, but it is like, oh God, I have to get up quite early on a Saturday now, depending on where it is.
Well, you'll be fascinated by the weather again.
I will. Yes.
I built so much furniture.
Oh yeah, because you moved, didn't you?
Yeah, I did, and I bought my first toolkit. I've got a hammer. I've got a cordless screwdriver. I don't know what I'm doing, but it's fun. I love tools. It's new toys, so that's been cool.
Yeah. No, I think definitely on my list of like big girl things is buying a full tool set.
Like, it was pink, but I don't know. I like it.
Yeah.
What have we got on the show today, Julia?
We've got quite a big show. I think you're kicking us off at 7:15, Faiza.
Absolutely. So at 7:15, we will have an interview with Saint for an event called Serviced, a variety spectacular that blends burlesque, circus, cabaret, sideshow, live music, and dance into one bold, glitter-soaked experience. Saint will be in studio, and I can't wait to have them with us.
And then at 7:30, Shelley and Sammy, who are two members of the Free Betty Coalition, a campaign to free Ibtissame Lashkar, who's a Moroccan feminist and human rights activist who's been sentenced to 30 months in prison in Morocco after sharing a photo of herself on social media wearing a t-shirt that says Allah is lesbian. And then at 7:45, we're going to be speaking to Elena Gomez, a writer and editor living on Wurundjeri country, who's just released her fourth poetry book called All Down Honey, exploring relationships between humans, animals and consumption. And then at 8 o'clock, we're going to be speaking to Maya, who is one of the founding directors of Young Prodigy, a youth-led organisation focused on mobilising young people impacted by parental and kinship family members who are in incarcerated, and we're going to be chatting about a recent inquiry into the youth justice and incarceration system in New South Wales and the organisation's campaign for free phone calls to prisons for family and kin.
Beautiful. And at 8:15 we will be wrapping up with a chat with Nellie Stevenson, an independent communications strategist who specialises in climate and energy. I'm sure everyone has seen the headlines. We are looking at price hikes for groceries, so we will be having a chat about that and the oil prices.
And now for our headlines.
Some folks know about it, some don't.
These are the news headlines for Tuesday, the 21st of April, 2026. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners, please note that the following story contains the names of deceased people. A second Aboriginal woman has died in Western Australia's Bunyip prison in less than 5 weeks. The National Indigenous Times has reported that 40-year-old Aboriginal woman was found unresponsive in her bed on Saturday. This comes 5 weeks after the death of Patricia Howells, also in Bunyip prison. And on Friday night, last week, a 54-year-old non-Indigenous male prisoner died at Dowerin Work Camp, Megan Krakauer, from the National Suicide Prevention and Trauma Recovery Project, told National Indigenous Times. The deaths showed the clear need for action from both the Western Australia and federal governments. Rising deaths and custody show that the current system is not delivering safe or consistent care. This outcome flies in the face of the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, which set out clear reforms that remain unimplemented. More than 630 Indigenous people have died in custody across so-called Australia since the Royal Commission brought down its findings and issued over 300 recommendations for reform in April 1991.
Also in the news, the Maribyrnong Council will be meeting today to vote on what it's called its civic presence model for Footscray. This comes after councillors unanimously voted for a security approach to social issues in Footscray. As reported by local group Footscray Community Response, the council's proposed civic presence is supposed to be a move away from compliance, security and enforcement. Instead, the revised model includes a welcome crew, which will consist of a precinct officer whose qualifications have not been defined, and a community development officer whose qualifications are based more around social work, with a focus on building relationships with people experiencing vulnerability. Footscray Community Response reports that the council has acknowledged a need to support the shared and equitable use of public space between people experiences homelessness and other forms of marginalization alongside the rest of the community. Despite these seemingly positive shifts in the council's approach, Footscray Community Response has urged others to continue monitoring both the police presence in Footscray as well as the implementation of the council's welcome crew. Please follow at Footscray Community for more information about this proposal.
In other news, Pacific government officials and leaders from non-governmental organizations came together last week to discuss the transition away from fossil fuels. The summit, which took place from April 13th to 15th in Colombia, announced a major declaration, the Tesuriki Call for Fossil-Free Pacific. The region has been facing a severe energy crisis amidst the fuel shortage caused by the U.S. and Israel's war on Iran. Many countries are threatened by power outages and haltage of basic services due to increasing fuel costs. The Tesuriki call urges the need for a fossil fuel treaty across the world to enact a fair but fast transition away from oil, gas, and coal. Tuvalu's Minister for Home Affairs, Environment and Climate Change, the Honorary Dr. Manny Atalia, commented, "For decades, the Pacific has led efforts to secure multilateral climate solutions. This declaration marks the beginning of the next chapter of our journey to a fossil-free future, setting a clear direction for a unified coalition of countries who are already to secure a fast and fair financed transition away from coal, oil, and gas production. Discussions will continue next week with more international leaders joining their Pacific counterparts in Santa Maria, Colombia.
And finally in the headlines, dozens of children, book bags in tow, marched on Sunday morning towards the fence blocking the route the children of the Bedouin community of Al-Khair used to reach their school in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. The school children held up posters, sang songs and chanted in English at soldiers who watched from the other side. For more than 40 days during the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran, Palestinian schools were closed in Al-Khair. When last week's ceasefire allowed Palestinian schools in the West Bank to reopen, even if for only 3 days a week, the children arrived to find the fence blocking the path to their school a kilometer away. When the children tried to go around the fence, soldiers launched tear gas and sound grenades at children as young as 5 years old. Security camera footage recorded by community members showed settlers coming during the night to erect the barbed wire fence. Desperate to get their children back in school, the community launched Sunday's march as part of a new initiative, the Al-Khair Freedom School. Until the path to school is reopened, the community will hold daily peaceful demonstrations with lessons, music, and activities conducted in the open air at the spot where the path is blocked. These have been the news headlines for Tuesday, 21st of April, 2026. You're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM.
Did you know that Western Sahara is Africa's last colony? The issue of Western Sahara was raised in the Eddie Mabo case referencing Terra Nullius. Western Sahara is illegally occupied by Morocco. Indigenous Sahrawis are denied their right to self-determination. France continues to veto United Nations human rights observation in Western Sahara. Sahrawi people are being killed by Israeli drones. Like to learn more? Become informed. Become an Australia Western Sahara Association member at awsa.org.au. Australian Western Sahara Association is a 3CR supporter.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalization intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
South liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo! Woo!
Kefias are Palestinian scarves, and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white kefia to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to kefias.org.au. That's kefias.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
I sing the words I will not say so.
Hey, this is Greta Ray, and you are listening to 3CR 855 AM Radical Radio on digital and streaming live on 3cr.org.au.
3CR, your station, your voice.
Then join Sally on Sundays at noon for Out of the Pan.
Welcome to Rainbows Don't Fade with Age on Radio 3CR.
Welcome to Trans Creator Radio.
Where history's queer futures is an audio journey into the stories.
Trans Day of Audibility, a day for us to be heard and not seen.
3CR, your station, your voice.
Make the call. Make the call.
We're diving into a show that's turning heads and challenging the ideas of masculinity in the most entertaining ways possible. It's called Serviced, a variety spectacular that blends burlesque, circus, cabaret, sideshow, live music, and dance into one bold, glitter-soaked experience. Today we're speaking to Saint, the mind behind this event. This is a special pre-Mother's Day edition. It's also a fundraiser, helping to take the show on tour across regional Australia, spreading queer joy and positive masculinity to emphasize femininity along the way. Welcome, Saint.
Hey.
Welcome. So sorry we've had such a rocky start
to this
morning.
No, it's been good. It's all good. You're all smashing it.
Yeah, I gotta have something to keep us on our toes.
That's it, other than our high heels.
Exactly. Well, for listeners who haven't heard of Serviced yet, how could you describe this event in one sentence?
The three key words I kind of use is muscles, mischief, and mental health. It's an all-mask presenting cabaret experience, not just a show. It's kind of a whole experience. Just kind of spreading the message of positive masculinity and men's mental health and the benefits that come from that.
Yeah, absolutely. In what ways does Serviced act as a love letter to mothers and women specifically?
I think the best present we can give our women, our mothers, our feminine community right now is the message of we are here for you, we are here to support, we are allies, we are accomplices, we are here to serve you in the best way we can. We want to serve our queens.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a very special message to be sending for a pre-Mother's Day event.
Yeah, especially, yeah, that's it.
Well, you describe Serviced as celebrating femininity from masculinity. Can you unpack that idea a little bit?
Yeah, a lot of my childhood, my mum was more masculine in my sense. So a lot of my femininity is that strong warrior. It's the assertive woman. It's the power behind. So femininity and masculinity for me doesn't really have gender. It's just got this beautiful spectrum of energies rather than biology.
Yeah, I think that's an amazing way to have an outlook on this kind of thing. I feel like it's a lot of the time trapped in a box, and this is breaking out of that box.
And it kind of lets us merge together and become humans rather than boys and girls and blah, blah, blah. It's literally just like we are one creature. Let's celebrate our similarities rather than differences.
Yeah, I think that's a really beautiful thing.
Thanks.
Well, what inspired the decision to place femininity at the heart of a show performed by all mask presenting cast members?
Femininity is the heart and masculinity is the soul. It's kind of just one big marriage of energy and like I said, that warrior woman kind of just pushed forward for me, and that's what I wanted to attack it with.
Yeah.
So it's got that heart.
Yeah, that's amazing.
The Mother Earth, right? It literally has to be that heart.
Yeah, exactly. Well, do you think masculinity and femininity are often seen as opposites? And how does service challenge that?
Yeah, for sure. They're always opposites. We're always taught them, right? Like boys in blue, girls in pink, blah, 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 blah. Girls are Barbies, boys are trucks. Yeah, I got it wrong already. Yeah, we're definitely shown as opposites, and it's really not. It's literally just one creature and just energies between that.
Yeah.
I forgot the second part of the question, sorry.
Well, yeah, how does service challenge this idea of being opposites?
So it kind of pushes that sense where it's like men in heels, which is typically, I mean, in the queer community, that's just another Tuesday. But in the mainstream world, obviously, it's still got those boundaries to push and people still aren't colouring with those pencils yet.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's the smallest part of it, but it pushes onto trauma and community and all that kind of sense and who's got your back and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, this show includes burlesque, cabaret, circus, and dance. How do all of these different art forms help express femininity in a powerful way?
They're all just tools, right? Like anything can be any kind of tool. So I was lucky enough to kind of explore through all of them through my career. So I kind of wanted all of them to kind of play this part in telling the story of community and of love and support. So
yeah,
they kind of just married each other quite nicely.
And in all of these forms of expression, how do you avoid portraying femininity as imitation instead of honoring it authentically?
So everyone is mask presenting in our show. So therefore we don't really do any sorts of drag or anything. We do one number where I come out in a wig and heels and a skirt, but I'm not impersonating a woman. It's just more of a expression of my feminine. It's a lot of words. Femininity. It's very early in the morning to say that. So it's never in impersonation. It's always just this love letter to it.
Yeah.
And letting my side of it come out rather than I am the other person.
Yeah, absolutely. And with the rooftop art and immersive elements, how does the environment support the celebration of femininity beyond the stage?
You can say femininity good in the morning. So Spiegel House have been lucky enough given us the rooftop. I've worked with them quite a lot. So they're really nice and give us the whole thing. So we've got art exhibits that me and a friend had collaborated together on an expression of masculinity through different backgrounds and ages and all that kind of stuff. We've got market stalls that kind of apply to Mother's Day treats and about celebrating the femininity and the womanhood. We've got people like Sugar, who's coming to do a tooth gems, who's just like, come sparkle up your life. It's just about like enriching your life in sparkle and joy and happiness. And I especially wanted to do something around Mother's Day because a lot of the queer community, like myself, don't have a great relationship with their families. So it's a nice place for them to come to and still feel loved and still celebrate those women and mother of the house or their own femininity kind of strength.
Yeah, I think it's really important to build that community and to give a safe space for those who feel like they don't have one on their own.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, this has been wonderful. My final question for you is that what can people expect when they walk in? If they're experiencing the rooftop or if they're experiencing the full event, all the shows?
Mayhem. No, it's very much controlled and it's very community-based no matter what it is. We've got some amazing roving performers. We've got some amazing community people coming in. So the show itself is ticketed, but the rooftop is free. So come and enjoy all that community stuff and just come be part of it, whether it's as a group or whether it's solo. Talk to a random and just chat.
Yeah,
yeah, connect.
Oh, thank you so much for coming
for
on the show this morning. Thanks for bearing with us through our
You got it. You're all killing it.
Yeah, it's been amazing to speak to you, and I can't wait for service.
Thanks, babe.
That was Saint talking about Serviced, a variety show that mixes performance, art, and community into one big, unapologetic celebration. It's happening as a pre-Mother's Day special on May 9th, raising funds to take the show on tour across regional Australia, with a full experience including bottomless drinks, rooftop installations, DJs, tarot, tattoos, live performance, tooth gems, and more. Whether you're just there for the show or soaking up the atmosphere, Serviced runs from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. and promises an afternoon that's bold, playful, and unforgettable.
Trans Family is a not-for-profit organization providing a peer support group for loved ones, including parents, siblings, extended family, and friends of a trans and gender diverse person. Trans Family runs discussion groups in person and online. We offer a safe space to share your experiences, ask any questions regarding your situation, and provide peer support. We are especially keen to hear from loved ones in regional and rural Victoria. Donations to Trans Family are tax deductible. For more information, visit transfamily.org.au or look for us on Facebook. Trans Family is a 3CR supporter.
Plus Pride Victoria is a not-for-profit organisation dedicated to equality and justice for multigender attracted people, including bi, pan, regardless of label, or no label at all. We organise community events and advocate for better policies and services. I Plus Pride runs discussion groups which offer a safe and fun space to share your experiences, ask any questions regarding your sexual identity, and provide peer support. I Plus Pride is especially keen to hear from multi-gender attracted people in regional and rural Victoria. Donations to I Plus Pride are tax deductible. For more information, visit our website at biplusprideVic.org.au, email info@biplusprideVic.org.au, or find us on Facebook or Instagram.
A 3CR supporter. I'm bisexual.
Has Centrelink made a decision you disagree with? Most Centrelink decisions can be appealed up to 3 times. Examples of decisions you can appeal include whether you're eligible for a payment, cancellation or suspension of your payment, how much you get paid, and Centrelink debts. One of the most common Centrelink decisions appealed are Centrelink debts. Centrelink will say you owe a debt if the staff determine you've been paid more than you should have. Debts can occur for a variety of reasons. In some instances, if there's been an administrative error or if you have special circumstances, you may not have to repay that debt. The appeal process is free, but time limits can apply and will affect your entitlement to back payment. Social Security Rights Victoria is a specialist community legal centre providing Victorians free advice to help you understand your Centrelink issues and the appeal processes. You can contact Social Security Rights Victoria on 9481 0355 or online at ssrv.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Shelley and Sammy are two members of the Free Betty Coalition, a campaign to free Ibtissam Betty Lushgar, a Moroccan feminist and human rights activist who has been sentenced to 30 months in prison in Morocco after sharing a photo of herself on social media wearing a t-shirt that read, "Allah is lesbian." In this conversation, Shelley and Sammy speak about Betty and her work as an artist and activist, her current condition being held in a prison in Morocco, and how the Free Betty Coalition is fighting for her freedom.
So I'm joined here this morning by Charlie and Sammy, who are here to talk to me about the Free Betty campaign. So thank you both so much for joining me on 3CR.
Thanks so much for having us. It's really great to have an opportunity to share Betty's story. So we really appreciate
it. So I'll start by asking you each to introduce yourselves to our listeners. And Charlie, I'll start with you.
Hi, everyone. I'm originally from Melbourne, now based in LA. This is a global campaign. Very, very proud to be part of the coalition defending and calling for the release of Betty.
Hi, everyone. My name is Sammy, and I am an ex-Muslim atheist and activist, and I'm part of Ex-Muslims International, who had originally sort of put the word out that Betty had been arrested. And so I'm really grateful to be here, and thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you both so much for joining me to speak about Betty. I'm not sure how many of our listeners would be familiar with her story. So Shelley, what can you tell me about Betty, who she is as a person, and what has happened to her?
So Betty, Ibtissam Betty Lashgar, is a Moroccan clinical psychologist, human rights activist, feminist activist, LGBTQ rights activist. She's been active in Morocco since 2009, when she started her first action for freedom of conscience. And she's become a name for that in Morocco. She was the first openly atheist woman in Morocco. She started MALI, which is the movement, alternative movement for individual liberties. And she has fought bravely for reproductive rights. She started the first ever day. She was co-founded the first day against transphobia and homophobia in Morocco. She has fought against virginity testing. She's done, she's kind of like a performance artist as well. She brings like art into her actions as well. She did it in Rabat, in Morocco, an action against violence against women, where she turned all of the fountains in the city red. And so she's always been on the radar of the authorities. And in last year, she's also a Paris resident. And last year, when she was coming back to Morocco to visit her mum, who was not well, there was a photo of her that went viral online. And it was from a previous action that she had done. It was a T-shirt that she was wearing in solidarity with two Iranian lesbians who had been sentenced to death. And the T-shirt said, "Allah is lesbian." She made it. It's part of a famous feminist quote from a French feminist from the 70s that said, "I met God. She's black, gay, and a communist." And so she had been inspired by this quote to make this T-shirt, "Allah is lesbian." And so she never wore the T-shirt in Morocco, but the photo went viral when she was visiting last year in July, and she started receiving a lot of death threats, a lot of harassment online, a lot of calls for her arrest. And eventually, after days and days of these threats, she reposted the photo of herself with some criticism of Morocco and Islam, and she was arrested on August 10th, and she's been in prison since then. She was sentenced to 30 months in jail for a T-shirt, for blasphemy, for offending Islam. She was sentenced to 30 months in jail for a T-shirt that she never wore in that country. And she has been, now it's been over 8 months, and her health has deteriorated severely in prison. Betty's a bone cancer survivor, and she has she survived in her 20s, and she lost her humerus bone in her left arm, so she now has a prosthetic and was scheduled for a replacement surgery for this prosthetic in September before she was arrested to go home to France for this specialized surgery that she needed. But when she was arrested and imprisoned unexpectedly, she was not able to get this essential specialized surgery that she needs, and her arm has deteriorated much more in prison, where she's being held without a mattress, where she was being held in solitary confinement for a long time. And that prosthetic is now completely detached. She's lost the use of her left arm, and she has early signs of infection from a scan. And so she's at a really, really critical risk now of amputation and even losing her life. So this is not just a campaign to free a hero, a human rights activist, a person who has put their life on the line for freedom of expression, freedom of speech, women's rights, like human rights activists, such a brave person risking their life. This is now a humanitarian issue for someone who's going to lose, who could lose their life in prison.
Thanks so much, Shelley, for sharing Betty's story with us. Now, Sammy, what can you tell me about the Free Betty campaign? Just looking at some of the posts on social media, it seems that it has become quite global. There are people sort of doing actions in solidarity with Betty from various different countries. But before that, I was wondering if you could just tell our listeners a bit about the history of the Free Betty campaign.
Sure. So I was basically part of sort of the original, you know, getting the word out about Betty through Ex-Muslims International. We're a coalition of ex-Muslim organizations and activists who basically campaign together. And so we put the word out, and honestly, Betty has made such wonderful impacts and connections through her work that it didn't take long for a lot of people to come together and go, we've got to get her out. And so since her unjust arrest and sentencing last year, we've been campaigning for her release and health with about 100 plus member organizations in the Free Betty Coalition. And everyone from Human Rights Watch to Amnesty International to All Out to Avaaz has had the biggest petition with over 350,000 signatures, a combined sort of over 400,000 signatures now that have been gathered to basically say, we've got to free Betty. And we've done specific actions, like, you know, recently on March 8th, we asked the king for a royal pardon. We've also done a mattress action where we actually brought mattresses to embassies, Moroccan embassies and consulates. And also a lot of these different actions, along with literally writing to politicians and government leaders in our own countries to urge Moroccans and the Moroccan officials to help free her. And so a lot of this has been going on, but despite our global efforts, the petitions, the media coverage, Betty still remains in prison on blasphemy charges. And what really just hurts the most about all of this is that it's particularly a woman wearing a t-shirt that she never wore in Morocco. And that's what really just, you know, I think all of us are left a little bit like flabbergasted, like how could this even happen in the first place? And yet we're continuing to, you know, speak up and connect with folks and get the word out so that we can hopefully get that royal pardon or get, in any case, get her out.
Thanks for that, Sammy. And I guess you alluded to this and spoke about it briefly in your answer just now, but Shelley, I was wondering if you can tell me if there has been any communication with Moroccan authorities through the Free Betty campaigns. Sammy just said that there was an action earlier in the year to ask for a royal pardon from the king. So, has there been any other response from Moroccan heads of state? And is there any ongoing communication with authorities regarding not only Betty's charges and arrest, but also her state in prison and how she's going?
So Betty does have reduced contact compared to the other prisoners where she is being held, but she is able to meet with her legal team or family who are able to be present once a week. So we do get to find out weekly about her state and how she is going and how her health has been deteriorating. The the communication that it can speak publicly of was an early UN Human Rights Council communication, where six relevant mandates together through the special procedures contacted the Moroccan authorities. They had questions about how she was being kept. They had questions about her state of health, and Morocco responded to that communication, which was made public this year. But we are looking through diplomatic channels to raise this across a multitude of countries, at the European Union Parliament, and also to escalate her case, her current open case with the UN.
Thank you, Shelley. And so if we can look to the demands of your campaign, obviously freeing Betty and having her pardon removed from prison is one of the priorities that both of you have mentioned. But yeah, Sammy, I was wondering if you could speak a bit more formally about the demands of the Free Betty campaign, and whether anything has come up for your campaign throughout the past, you know, 8-10 months of fighting and activism in her name.
Yeah, honestly, we want to see our friend Betty safe, free, and healthy. It's as simple as that. And, you know, we want to make sure that even with the time that she has been in prison, she has not gotten the actual medical attention that she needs. And that is one of our main concerns, just her being in the condition that she is would sort of her health deteriorating, but also these cruel prison conditions where it's included isolation, having no mattress, no pillow. And so this is actually hurting her even more than it would have if she maybe had these things. There has been a little bit of sort of getting her to a doctor, you know, once this campaign kicked off and we were making a lot of noise. That did happen. And also, it didn't happen to the point where she actually got the medical care that she actually needs for the cancer that she has, and the immediate and specialized sort of care that she needs for her, specifically for her arm. And so, yes, there's some things that happen, but largely it's been pretty much we have heard not much from Moroccan officials. And we're really hoping that her name is included in the next round of royal pardons that the king does. And he usually does them around the Islamic holiday of Eid. So twice a year he does that, or there's like a royal day, like a king's pardon day that happens. So we're hoping that her name gets included in that next time. And we're doing everything we can to speak up about this.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast, and that was Shelley and Sammy from the Free Betty Coalition, an international campaign to free Betty Lashkar, who is currently being held in prison in Morocco. And you can find out more by going to freebetty.org or at freebettyorg on Instagram. Up next, Houda Abouz is a Moroccan rapper and women's right advocate who performs under the name Kadek, which in Darija Moroccan Arabic means your sister, and it's used by men as a way of insulting one another, but was reappropriated by Houda. She's also very open about her mental health, having been diagnosed with bipolar in 2016, and this is her song called Bizarre. صافي قوى منتاني في كاسي قلبي كله غرازي بيلي ساكن بيكي قولي فازي نسيلهم صافي قوى في كاسي قلبي غرازي بين ساكن بيكي فازي راسي اللي بقى ليا اللي حقر عليك وري ليا يا راسي اللي بقى ليا اللي تقلت عليك خففت عليا
My universe خاصك لي فيزا غير Today on 3CR, we will be speaking with Elena Gomez, a writer and editor living on Wurundjeri country, who has recently released her fourth poetry book, All Down Honey. It is a book that paints a visceral image of the ecological crisis that is occurring as a result of late-stage capitalism. Welcome to 3CR, Elena.
Thanks for having me.
No worries. Thanks for coming on. So, can you tell me about your recent book release, All Down Honey?
Yes, so this is my sort of latest poetry book, and it is actually a sequence of five long poems. Mm-hmm. And they came out of research I was doing into the relationship between capitalism and colonialism and ecological crisis. But as I was writing, I found myself just kind of really exploring all these kind of minute experiences and relations between different kind of experiences. So there's a lot about stone fruit. There's a lot about deep sea mining, animals. It's a kind of a sprawling sequence. But I guess the thing tying it together is this question of how do we conceptualize these overlapping crises that are always a little bit interconnected but often tackled like independently. Mm-hmm.
As I was reading it, I found that very fascinating, the interconnections between food and these sort of like industrial themes that I think we are inherently related but not something that we necessarily link as we're experiencing things like fruit or things like stone fruit. Because I did have the question. So why was stone fruit a big focus within the poetry?
Accidentally, because the way that I write poetry is when I'm writing, I'm sort of suddenly quite porous to a lot of things going on in my life. And it actually just happened that I was spending some time with poets in the Bay Area in San Francisco. Mm. And I had a friend who was introducing me to some really wild stone fruit hybrids that I'd never come across before. And I just felt really fascinated by them. I just taken by them. And, you know, I've said to my other poet friends that poetry is often just like an exploration of obsessions. And so I sort of left myself open to that obsession, which happened to be stone fruit at the time. For a brief period, I think it was mandarins, and I think that's in there a little bit as well, but less obviously.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's really, really cool. And I think it's a great metaphor. And yeah, it's so satisfying. And that's so true. Like poetry is about exploring, what feels poetic to you. And that, I guess, so I guess it's such an interesting contrast with the like numbers aspects in your poetry and the discussion surrounding like the production or like trade routes. Could you tell me how you got to that point of like blending those things and and about that choice?
Yes. Okay. So I have to talk a bit about my PhD research now, but part of that was leading me to think a lot about the ocean And there's this book by Liam Campling and Alejandro, whose surname I forget right now, but it's called Capitalism and the Sea. And it was just this really incredible history of how the ocean and the sea kind of, I guess, capitalism tried to rein it in, but the sea cannot be. And so it was looking at, yeah, the history of trade routes, the history of even just fossil fuels and ports for ships and the way that port cities developed to help enable trade routes, but also, you know, marine wildlife and the fishing industries around the world and the way that, capitalism and merchant kind of histories were trying to establish, yeah, this control over the ocean and that the ocean just cannot be controlled in that way. And so I was thinking a lot about how so many parts of how we live now are kind of informed by these historic moments in capitalism. And I think that's just kind of always in my mind somewhere. And so it comes out in the poetry, and I'm not intending to put these things together so deliberately, but it comes out and then you can kind of see, yeah, the connections. One thing I was thinking about as well was when you were talking about industry and food. Mm. So there's this famous example in Marx where he talks about the soil in England, the quality of soil, getting kind of degenerated by, like, agriculture. And then at the same time, colonialism in South America. And the link is that they start kind of importing guano from South America to help regenerate the soil. So you have this initial kind of idea of colonialism enabling an industrial production of food. So I found that really interesting. And I guess that's kind of in the background in these poems as well.
Yeah, 100%. I'm really glad that you're writing about that because, yeah, I think food production and the way it's changed over time so much, yeah, is such a result of colonialism and capitalism, and it's so, like, distanced from, yeah, like, sort of like a natural cycle that's so forced in some way. So it's so interesting to read read your poetry discussing those themes. I think they're super important, especially because food seems like such a wholesome theme, but when you, yeah, look between the lines of how we receive it, it's so complex.
Yeah, I think as well, because for me, poetry is also like a really delightful form. It's really playful and it's really sensory. And so I'm thinking about these serious topics, but it's always through this sense of, like, playing with language and not always being so serious, because I'm not always a serious person.
yeah, that's awesome. Like, yeah, I feel like your poems have such an interesting texture as well.
Yes, I love texture. I love words with texture.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, do you have, like, a method of, like, creating that texture?
I don't have a method, but I think what I've learned to do over the years is to be really attentive to sensations in my body and being led by sounds and sensations before meaning. And then the meaning kind of comes through that. But when I try to write a poem about something specific, I really struggle. So, yeah, I think being led by sounds, even just a phrase or a word I come across will just stick with me for a long time, and then it'll find its way into maybe 3 or 4 different poems. But, yeah, I think it's less a method and more an orientation, or like a way of being open to it.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I think that's such a playful way to create poetry. So for my last question, what's the best way that listeners can find out more about your work?
Good question. Well, the book that I've got coming out is called All Down Honey, and it's being published by Vagabond Press. So There's more information about that on Vagabond's website. I think it's just vagabondpress.net. And it's part of a series of books. So there's like four other poets publishing as well at the same time. And they publish really exciting and innovative work. So that would be the main place to check it out. And then you can kind of find more information from there.
Great. Thank you so much for coming on to 3CR today, Eleanor.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks. We've been speaking with Eleanor Gomez, a writer and editor who's recently released her fourth poetry book, All Down Honey. For more information, you can find Eleanor Gomez's website as well, eleanorgomez.net, and we'll link the book in our podcast notes. You're listening to 3CR.
Up next, we're going to listen to a song called Sugar Mummy Snack by Araminta, a Nam-based singer-songwriter who creates home-produced music fusing modern feminine pop with folk influences.
Said if you want it, baby, you can have it. 2500 lender with no baggage. Digging through his pockets, hitting all his credit. Hard to see a man losing where he's heading. It's nice to see a man losing where he's heading. I just want more money than the man. I want more money. I want more money. Be a sugar mummy snack. I wanna be a sugar mummy snack. A sugar mummy snack is a girl who walks with glamour. Walk into the room, draw the floor, dick in your hand. Money don't smell, but I wear it like it's perfume. I gotta quit my job, serving plates, won't pay my bills. Gotta quit my job, serving plates won't pay my bills. A bills. I just want more money than the man. I want more money. I want more money. More money than the man. I want more money. More money than the man. I wanna be a sugar mommy snack. I wanna be a sugar mommy snack. So I better start working hard.
Don't be late again.
Bad energy disregard.
Get up and make your bed.
Fill my shift with some
haters and love. Not your friends. You're wasting time on them.
So I better start working hard.
Don't be late again.
Bad energy disregard.
Get up and make your bed.
Fill my shift with some love. Watch who
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast, and that was Sugar Mummy Snack by Araminta. And up next, we're going to be speaking to Maya, who is a founding director at Young Prodigy, a youth-led organisation focused on mobilising young people impacted by parental and kinship incarceration. And Maya joins us today to discuss the work of Young Prodigy, including their recent participation in an inquiry into the youth justice and incarceration system in New South Wales. And we'll also talk about Young Prodigy's campaign for free phone calls to prisons for family and kin and the positive impact that this would have on young people. Welcome to 3CR, Maya.
Thanks, Juliet. Happy to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us this morning, Maya. To start off with, could you tell us a little bit about some background to Young Prodigy and how the organisation came to be?
Yeah, absolutely. So Young Prodigy was formally established in 2023 from lived expertise. So from that, we really knew firsthand how invisible the issue of parental incarceration is. No one else in the system is really acknowledging this experience, and it kind of intersects with so many other harmful institutions as well, right? So we know that a lot of people with this experience have contact with out-of-home care, youth detention themselves, mental health institutions and things like this. So it was just kind of like this very glaring gap within the sector that we wanted to close. So, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, it really speaks to that, cycle of incarceration as well, that, as you're saying, young people who experience their parents being incarcerated are at a much, higher risk themselves of, experiencing incarceration. And as you said, there isn't much out there addressing this systemic issue. And to start off with, could you talk a little bit about how young people are impacted by their parents being incarcerated? What does that look like on their lives?
Yeah, so when young people experience the incarceration of a parent, kind of everything shifts almost overnight. So there's a lot of financial hardship that's put on young people. There's a lot of stigma, housing insecurity, impacts on education and things like this. So I guess your core structure and your core foundation kind of gets removed automatically. And then this, I guess, parentification of your existence kind of gets placed on you as a result of that. So it kind of touches every single facet of your life, really. We see that manifest in different ways for a lot of the young people that we connect with. So, for example, we have some young people that were, born inside, all the way to young people who have been inside themselves simultaneously with their parents as well. So it kind of, can show up in different ways. But that's just a few of the core high-level ways that it does impact young people.
Yeah, no, it really does have such a big impact. And, as you're saying as well, it means that young people, are, as you said, parentified and have to, really step up and, don't get to have that experience of being a child from such a young age. Has just so many ramifications on young people's lives. And I know in the last few weeks, Young Prodigy has been, out and about and, really getting that message across through participating in the Senate Committee's inquiry in Parramatta in New South Wales, in which, there was a discussion about youth justice and incarceration. Could you speak to what were some of the key points made by advocacy groups such as Young Prodigy at the inquiry?
Yeah, absolutely. So first off, I should mention that there were two inquiries that were kind of happening simultaneously. So you have the New South Wales Youth Justice Inquiry and then you have the Federal Youth Justice Inquiry. Mm. So Young Prodigy made a submission to the New South Wales one. However, we were asked to give evidence to the federal one. So we were kind of spreading ourselves across those two different spaces. But at a high level, I guess what was really important for us in contributing to this inquiry was that because no one is talking about parental incarceration, it was really important that we kind of include this experience in these justice-related dialogues. So what we know is that parental incarceration basically directly shapes a young person's pathway into the justice system, or one of the ways young people can be guided into the justice system, and it's not a peripheral issue from youth justice itself. So I think that was a really important thing that we highlighted. While I don't necessarily love this framing, I mean, the stats are the stats, but more than half of the young people in New South Wales youth detention facilities have reported having a parent incarcerated, and for First Nations young people, that's, almost at 70%. So we can see that there's a clear pipeline client and a clear connection between parental incarceration and how state surveillance from that experience can follow a young person inside themselves. So, yeah, they were some of the key things that we highlighted on top of what I discussed earlier around out-of-home care as well. There were some really clear things that came through.
Yeah, it sounds like such an important conversation and, yeah, really helpful as well, I guess, to know what those statistics are to just get a sense of, yeah, the magnitude of and the extent to which young people, particularly Aboriginal young people, are being impacted. And I know, yeah, as part of a lot of your work, you've been sharing the stories of young people who are connected to Young Prodigy. Would you be able to, yeah, with our listeners, tell us maybe an example of a story of, yeah, a young person connected to Young Prodigy and how they've been impacted by the system?
I mean, yes. But I would actually kind of love to talk a little bit more about the pieces of work that we have just because, yeah, it's me on the phone here today and I don't really have a young person here with me. But
yeah, sure,
I guess
sure.
This definitely speaks to, I guess, a collective story per se. But one of the pieces of work that we're really pushing at the moment is to make phone calls free across New South Wales. And I think the fact that the system loves to commodify connection and commodify phone calls is a shared story and a shared experience with a lot of the young people who are connected directly with Young Prodigy. So phone calls are directly linked to helping with rehabilitation and connecting back to the outside world once someone has finished their sentence. And when that becomes inaccessible and when that's not made available, it's just an extra layer of disadvantage that our communities are experiencing. So what we do know is that Telstra has secured a contract in New South Wales for over $160 million, and that has been and that's going to be operating up until the end of 2027. So ourselves and a lot of our young people are really campaigning to ensure that this is accessible and that this is free and that people can remain connected.
Yeah, definitely. And would you be able to speak a little bit more to, what some of the current barriers are, you know, with this lack of given that phone calls are very costly for families to stay connected.
Yeah, absolutely. So at the moment, calling a mobile from inside does cost you $2.60 for every 10 minutes. And on top of that, when someone is inside, they're making incredibly low wages. I wouldn't even call it a wage at that. I think that's me being quite generous. But what we know is that up to 20% of an incarcerated person's wage, quote unquote, inside goes directly to these phone calls and being able to access contacting loved ones. So when that is the case and, you know, people inside are also needing to pay for things like food or bare basics like deodorant and linen and things like this, what we see is that financial burden is then put on young people or family members outside to provide those financial assistance in order to remain connected. So I think from a financial standpoint, particularly as we know that First Nations young people or First Nations people rather are the most incarcerated people on the planet, as well as high rates of cold communities as well. This extra financial barrier is another systemic disadvantage that communities are experiencing.
Yeah, definitely. And it really would be adding up and such a just another barrier for families in staying connected as well. And I know, you've got a lot planned in the coming months to get the message out with this campaign. Could you speak to what the demands are of Young Prodigy in this campaign?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have two very clear, very core demands. The first is to make phone calls free across New South Wales facilities to all nominated numbers. And the second demand that we have is to ensure that there's an increase in devices so that people can have more accessibility to making those calls once they're made free. So there are our two demands.
Yeah, for sure. And in terms of for our listeners, how can they get involved with supporting the campaign? Are there any steps that they can take to support you in achieving these demands?
Yeah, absolutely. There are a few things that you can do. So first off, jump on our website, youngprodigy.org. Young is spelled Y-U-N-G. And then under our campaigns tab on the website, you'll find the Freedom on the Line webpage. And there's a bunch of information there, kind of highlighting at a higher level or a more detailed level, rather, what the campaign's about, the stats around it, the importance of it. And you're able to sign a petition from there. Once you sign that petition, you'll be given like a media kit or automatically that kind of gives you key messages that you can use when having conversations within your communities, or a media kit where you can share some social media tiles as well. So that's one way that you can support. Another way is we're based in Sydney on Gadigal land, we've been hosting these letter writing sessions where a group of people will kind of come together and write letters to the Minister and the Commissioner for Corrective Services in New South Wales in support of the campaign. I mean, if you're based also coming to Sydney anytime soon, please keep an eye out on our socials to see when the next one's popping up, or do one yourself. Like, we love when we see community members kind of mobilising in their own areas and regions and, yeah, spreading our message a lot further. So there are some different ways that you can support. Our Instagram is youngprodigy.org, all one word, if you want to follow us there.
Yeah, thank you so much, Maya. And definitely will encourage our listeners to go online and support the campaign. And really love the idea of the community coming together and the events that you're running, bringing the community together to write those letters is so powerful. And we really wish you all the best in the Freedom on the Line campaign.
Thanks so much, Julia. It's been great to see you on with you.
Yeah, you too. Well, thank you so much for getting up early, Maya, and chatting to us. Have a great rest of your day.
You too. Ciao.
Bye. We've been speaking to Maya, who's founding director at Young Prodigy, an organisation mobilising young people impacted by parental and kinship incarceration, about a parliamentary inquiry and their campaign for free phone calls to prison called the Freedom on the Line campaign. And if you want to find out more information, you can go to youngprodigy.org or at youngprodigy on Instagram, and that's young, Y-U-N-G, to look it up. And you can find out more online.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. 3CR is determined to stay independent. This means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We serve our community, not corporate interests. But this also means we do rely on people like you to keep the station running. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, 3CR relies on community donations to survive. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
There are all kinds of reasons people end up with issues with alcohol and other drugs, and it's nothing new. Hi, I'm Professor Scott Wilson from the not-for-profit Aboriginal Drug and Alcohol Council. What always helps is to reflect on what life might be like without the substance abuse, and then take action. Step one is simple. See your GP or drug and alcohol worker and ask for help today. You can visit us at adac.org.au.
A 3CR supporter.
The law is part of our everyday lives, including when we buy something, use a service, have a job, or rent a house. The law can be used to help protect and support families when there is violence in the home or disputes over parenting arrangements. Sometimes we might need to understand the law to navigate specific government systems like Centrelink, getting a residency visa, or if we come into contact with the police. Community legal centres provide free, quality legal advice and assistance to help people with everyday legal problems. We focus on working with people who are experiencing disadvantage, such as financial hardship, family violence, homelessness, and discrimination. Community legal centres are independent, non-government organisations and can be found across Victoria and Australia. If you're experiencing a legal problem, your local community legal centre may be able to help. To find a community legal centre near you, visit the Federation of Community Legal Centres Victoria at www.fclc.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast on 21st of April. Up next, we will now chat with Nellie Stevenson, an independent communications strategist specializing in climate and energy. She has worked with some of the world's most recognizable environmental and human rights organizations, and her work influences some of the loudest voices in the Australian climate and energy space. In recent times, she's shared about how we simply can't drill our way out of this energy crisis. Welcome, Nellie. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Hi, Nellie. So I guess to start us off, we could just jump straight into the headlines today. You know, grocery prices are going up due to shortages caused by US attacks on Iran. Could you, I guess, perhaps outline the oil crisis and how it impacts us here?
Absolutely. I mean, so who would have thought that Trump would make an illegal attack on a country in West Asia and
what now
bread and milk prices would go up? So how this works is that basically every single thing that is grown on a farm in Australia requires diesel. It either requires diesel to operate the machinery or diesel to get the trucks to Woolworths or Coles or whichever. I mean, pick your evil supermarket, right?
Yep.
And so what's happened is that Iran has closed this tiny little arterial waterway called the Strait of Hormuz, which is where 20% of the world's oil comes from. Now, oil is then processed into diesel petrol, and so diesel fuel. And so now we're in this position where suddenly we're in a fuel crisis in Australia and our groceries are going up because Trump wants to hit the big red button and bomb a bunch of countries on the other side of the world.
Fun for us, yeah. That's obviously a massive issue on the geopolitical scale. But a very critical point that you've been arguing for recently is essentially how, I mean, I think we'll jump back to that in a bit, but like specific to Australia, right? You've been arguing that coal and mining is not sustainable or even feasible for us at this point. We can't drill our way out of this energy crisis. What do you mean by that? Could you chat about that a bit more?
Oh, absolutely. So what we see generally anytime there's like some sort of shock or disruption or challenge to our energy system in Australia, we see people with vested interests from the coal and gas lobby start suddenly screaming for more domestic drilling, basically. And so what we're seeing in this instance is primarily the Queensland Premier, Chris Afulli, is suddenly going, jumping up and down, screaming Eureka like he's struck gold, going, oil in Queensland, let's drill for oil in Queensland.
Yeah.
And so, yes, they have found there is some oil in Queensland, but unfortunately the situation in Australia is that we don't have any good oil left. If we had good oil, we would have a major domestic production of oil because one thing, you know, that is very true about Australia is that we love the resources sector here and that we seem to be determined to pull anything out of the ground and sell it that we possibly can. And so this oil that they have, that they're jumping up and down about in Queensland is really subpar oil. Like it can be processed into pretty subpar fuels, mainly sort of used machinery oils and stuff like that. But it's the thing is that this facility that they're, you know, pitching in Queensland can only really process, you know, a couple of hundred barrels of oil a day in a country that uses several hundred million, if not billions of barrels of oil a day. And so effectively what we're seeing is this big push by the Liberal Queensland government to start a domestic oil industry off this premise that just doesn't really make any sense. So they're not going to make a dent. It's not the kind of oil that we can produce into diesel at a mass scale in order to, you know, bring our grocery prices back down. And what we also see with this conundrum with diesel fuels is that being a fossil fuel, it's responsible for climate change. So when we see these huge shocks to grocery prices, inevitably they are caused by, in one way or another, there'll be some climate impact that happens in a food growing region.
Absolutely,
that then pushes down supply, drives up demand, and that's when we see bananas at like $12 a kilo. So the irony here is that we need diesel to get those bananas to our kitchen table, but burning diesel drives climate change.
Absolutely.
And so that then causes the extreme weather events that are knocking the bananas out of production. And so at both ends of the spectrum, diesel is making our food growing harder. It's making our prices more expensive. And so what we really need to see right now is fewer cars on the road doing, you know, the school run, doing groceries powered by diesel, and really save that fuel for the industries that need it, like agriculture, because they're not able to, you know, they're not able to electrify as fast as our passenger vehicles are.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess that's part of the push with the free public transport and half price public transport for the rest of the year that's coming up, I guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, like that you were already making all those ties already, because as we know, crisis doesn't happen in a vacuum, and struggles are very much intersectional, and the struggle for fossil fuel is very much tied to, you know, the various wars and genocides that we are witnessing across the world today. What are some of the links, I guess, that you've noted already in relation to that?
I mean, the consistent theme across all of them right now is fossil fuels.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Venezuela, which Trump illegally attacked recently, has tons of oil, you know, and that's ultimately the driving factor which behind Trump wanting to go in and make those attacks, is because they've got lots and lots of oil. He wants to take that and sell that as an American industry.
Yeah.
And then you've got Iran, which, of course, he's still, you know, very, very active, active conflict happening over there. Iran controls one of the arteries of the global oil market. Trump illegally attacks them, drunk on power from the Venezuela attacks, wants to control the Strait of Hormuz. But then you've got, zooming out even further, I mean, there are 32 billion cubic metres of gas off the coast of Gaza.
Yeah, yeah.
This is part of, you know, like often people talk about clearly the horrific things that Israel is doing in Gaza, but what few people understand is that there is a huge fossil fuel motivator there. There
are
an extraordinary amount of gas off the coast of Gaza, and you start to see this link where, you know, ultimately one of the, I read recently, one of my colleagues had said that electrification is an act of peace. So getting off fossil fuels is an act of peace, because if you really look, particularly a lot of the conflict that happens in West Asia or the Middle East, for those playing at home, is ultimately has some link to oil industry, the gas industry, and, you know, consistently commodifying those assets, pulling them out of the ground, burning them. Who's going to make the most money out of them?
Absolutely.
But then you zoom out even further and you look at the climate impact of those wars.
Yeah,
where I've seen data recently that says that Israel's bombs on Gaza have added an additional 33 million tons of climate pollution.
Exactly, yeah.
Like, that is an extraordinary amount. That's equal to the amount of some entire countries.
Yeah, and we'll be paying for that for, you know, generations to come. Right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So not only is Israel causing immense suffering, you know, in Gaza at this very minute by dropping those bombs, but it's locking in suffering for generations to come, for children that haven't even been born yet on the other side of the world.
Absolutely. And of course, we are already hearing, you know, reports of, you know, children being born in Gaza today with, you know, all kinds of deformities and, you know, health issues from birth, because obviously their moms, you know,
under extreme stress,
exactly,
trauma,
yeah,
you know, like,
yeah.
I've been pregnant before. They basically wrap you in cotton wool and they go, don't do anything that might harm the baby. And, you know, being pregnant in a war zone, like, of course these children
imagine.
Are being born.
Yeah.
Under challenging circumstances.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. I think we definitely have to bring you back to chat more, because this is definitely a conversation that needs to keep happening. But thank you so very much for joining us today. Thank you, Nelly. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for having me. See ya.
We've been listening to Nelly Stevenson, an independent communications strategist specializing in climate and energy. And she was just sharing about how the impact of the oil crisis, obviously horrific for everyone across the world, but in particular has made its way down to our shores, with grocery prices now being reported to be going up in the coming weeks.
And For the next week, these are the events that are happening in the community. So on the 22nd of April at 6 p.m, there'll be the Introduction to Thinking Strategically, Revolution in Australia, at the new International Bookshop at Trades Hall. Also will be held online. On the 22nd at 6 p.m, there will also be On the Ground in Palestine, Accelerating Israeli Fascism Eyewitness Accounts at the Kathleen Sim Library in Faraday Street, Carlton. And from the 27th of April to the 3rd of May is Palestine Solidarity Week, organised by university campuses across the country, including at the University of Melbourne.
And we've had a big show today. So starting off at 7:15, Elena spoke to St. Williams from the event Serviced, a variety spectacular blending burlesque, circus, cabaret, sideshow, live music and dance. And was exploring themes of masculinity and femininity in an entertaining way. And then at 7:30, we had an interview that Fung did with Shelley and Sammy, two members of the Free Betty Coalition, a campaign to free Betty Lashkar, who's currently being held in prison in Morocco. And then at 7:45, Julia spoke to Elena Gomez, a writer and editor living on Wurundjeri country, who's just released her fourth poetry book, All Down Honey. Then at 8 a.m, I spoke to Maya, who is the founding director of Young Prodigy, a youth-led organisation focused on mobilising young people impacted by parental and kinship incarceration, and spoke about their recent participation in a Senate inquiry, both federally and in New South Wales, and also about Young Prodigy's campaign Freedom on the Line for free phone calls to prisons. And then finally at 8:15, Visa spoke to Nellie Stevenson, an independent communication strategist specialising in climate and energy, spoke about the impact that climate crisis and also fuel shortage crisis are having on cost of living, and why we need to, simply can't drill our way out of this energy crisis. And I think that's all we've got time for today. Thank you so much for listening.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.